Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8, text 19. Translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Open the book on the right page. Bhuta grama sa evayam. Bhutva bhutva praliyate. Ratriagame vashaf partha. Prabhavatyahar agame. Bhuta grama sa evayam. Bhutva bhutva praliyate. Ratri agame vashaf partha. Prabhavatyahar agame. Again and again, when Brahma's day arrives, all living entities come into being, and with the arrival of Brahma's night, they are helplessly annihilated. Purport. The less intelligent who try to remain within this material world may be elevated to higher planets, and then again must come down to this planet Earth. During the daytime of Brahma, they can exhibit their activities on higher and lower planets within this material world. But at the coming of Brahma's night, they are all annihilated. In the day, they receive various bodies for material activities, and at night, they no longer have bodies, but remain compact in the body of Vishnu. Then again, they are manifest at the arrival of Brahma's day. Bhutva bhutva praliyate. During the day, they become manifest, and at night, they are annihilated again. Ultimately, when Brahma's life is finished, they are all annihilated and remain unmanifest for millions and millions of years. And when Brahma is born again in another millennium, they are again manifest. In this way, they are captivated by the spell of the material world. But those intelligent persons who take to Krishna consciousness use the human life fully in the devotional service of the Lord, chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Thus they transfer themselves, even in this life, to the spiritual planet of Krishna and become eternally blissful there, not being subject to such rebirths. Bhuta grama sa evayam bhutva bhutva praliyate ratriagame vashaf partha prabhavatya haragame. This verse is based on the Vedic worldview regarding cosmology. It does not support Big Bang theory. The Big Bounce might be closer. You all heard of the Big Bang. There was nothing, and then it exploded. Well, there was an explosion. You can't say nothing exploded. And then everything came into being, all the laws of science and everything exactly fine-tuned so that we're here today. And what's the proof? Well, we're here today. Couldn't have been here if it wasn't for that. Obviously, the worldview given here in the Bhagavad Gita is very different to that which is widely accepted as the scientific view. Although, if we look a little deeper, we'll find that there really isn't one scientific view of almost anything. Once you get beyond 2H2 plus 2O2 forms 2H2O, and then once you get beyond that, things get more complex. some years ago, it was quite a few years ago, I saw in a magazine that among astrophysicists, there are about 2,000 theories about the origins of the universe or the non-origins of the universe, solid state theory or big bounce is another non-origins. Big bounce means it all explodes and then recedes back into itself and then again comes out. Like I say, that's closer to the Vedic version of the universe is coming out in seed form from the Mahavishnu, Karanadakshai Vishnu. So 2,000 theories, I thought at the time, this must have been more than 20 years ago, I read it. I thought at the time, well, there probably are many more than 2,000 astrophysicists in the world, and there are 2,000 theories. I spoke to an astrophysicist about this, and she said that, yeah, well, some of them have more than one theory. So when we speak about the scientific worldview, she also told me when she first went to a Hare Krishna center that the sannyasi was told that this astrophysicist who's taking interest in Krishna consciousness is coming. So don't speak anything about, or you know, be careful what you say about astrophysics, anything like that. So he said in the course of his lecture, these astrophysicists, they don't know what they're talking about. And she told me she was very impressed because she thought, how does he know we don't know what we're talking about? Anyway, I'm speaking on this today in response to an article which appeared in the Swaraja magazine, which you probably never heard of. I never heard of it until just 2 days ago. It's called Vedic creationists exclamation mark. Thankfully, they are relegated to the fringe. This article was written by Aravindan Neelakandan, good Tamil name. He is a co-author of the book Bhaktivedanta, I've been working on the Bhaktivedanta Institute, so I'm working on one essay about that. Breaking India, he's a co-author of Breaking India. He's not as well known as Rajiv Malhotra, but apparently Aravindan did a huge amount of research for that book, and clearly from this article he's a competent writer also. As you probably know, I appreciate that book. It documents in much detail how various political forces are conspiring to break India, both politically and to break the culture and to break the willpower. It's quite well known that this process was started in the 19th century with the British, who were ruling India at the time, deliberately wanting to buckle India at the knees intellectually, because they thought, we can't rule India, we can't capture the minds of the people unless we break their faith in Shastra and the Brahmins. So they had a very clever, cunning, insidious program to undermine Indian culture, or Vedic culture, we could say, because sometimes when you say Indian culture, people say, what about the Muslims? They're also part of Indian culture, which actually they are, just like Hindi. As it's spoken today, there's at least as much Urdu as Sanskrit, I think more, isn't it? Mostly, it depends who you're speaking with, but in common parlance, definitely there's more Urdu than Sanskrit. This process didn't stop with the British leaving. You may wonder if you read the most of the English language, especially English language, now it's coming to the vernacular languages of India, if you read their newspapers and magazines, why they're so much against traditional Indian culture. Well, I found out from Breaking India, because young people who show promise in journalism, they're given sponsorship. Scholarship. That's the word. To go to study in America journalism, and then they get fed with all the how India is so bad, caste system, burning brides, it's all bad. And they come back and they think, oh yeah, this is what we they're on a mission to destroy that culture. And they're doing a pretty efficient job, I must say, in destroying the culture. So there's many more things in that book, but I appreciate that book, and I've recommended that the leaders of our movement here in India read that book to understand what we're up against, because there's the Western powers, especially from America now, America, Britain, this intellectual undermining, and then Marxists, Islamists, and Christians. And actually, it's a fact. I know from one tribal area that we have some activity in Gujarat, they tell me that the Christians and the Maoists work together against the Hindu culture. Why should Maoists are supposed to be Marxists, atheists, but they have a common cause. They want to break the belief of the people in Hinduism. I'm using the word Hindu here in a conventional sense, because it's one of those terms which everyone understands what it means until you try to understand it. Words like mind and love and green. Everyone knows what greens mean. If you try to define it, you can't precisely define it. So I'm using it in a conventional sense. I'm going to be using it quite a lot. I was talking about Aravindan. You may remember I invited him when we had our Shravan Kirtan camp in Guruvayur. I invited him to speak on this topic, which he kindly did. He came. So I'm not going to discuss everything in his article. This article, which I'm referring to, it's an attack on what he calls Vedic creationism. Yeah, that's creationism is a term largely connected with Christianity, the Christian creationists, those who believe that creation took place by God according to the description in the Bible, although the description in the Bible is not very clear. The description in the Vedic literature is in much more detail. And creationism doesn't have a good name among people who subscribe to the scientific worldview. What, again, if you say scientific worldview, you get a general idea of what it means. It's like a word like Hindu, but what exactly does it mean? Very difficult to say, but you can. So I'm going to respond to this article, which is specifically an attack upon Dhrutakarma Prabhu, our God-brother, who is promoting Vedic creationism. And he quotes the book Forbidden Archaeology. Aravinda Nilakantan promotes this, or he speaks about this book, which was written with Sadaputta Prabhu. He's not attacking Sadaputta Prabhu so much, because Sadaputta Prabhu is no longer with us. He passed away several years ago. I'm just wondering why he's suddenly bringing this up almost 25 years after the book was published, and Dhrutakarma Prabhu has been very active ever since. His response, Aravindan's response to this book, it's dismissive. It's as if it's, he says, oh, it's amusing, as if it's just some childish foolishness. His response is somewhat ad hoministic, just just calling bad names, although it's not all like that. Notwithstanding that Drutakarma Prabhu's work is taken seriously by many people all over the world, it does. He's invited to established universities to speak. So even the people who invite him to speak, it's not necessarily that they agree with what he say, but they do. At least you can say that he's invited to speak in such fora, means that they do recognize that he has a lucid message to put across, even if they want to defeat it. It's not just, as Aravindan says, just something amusing. And it's not just some child blabbering some nonsense. It is taken seriously by qualified people. And intelligent design, which is the intelligent design theory, which is linked with creationism, although those who promote intelligent design don't necessarily promote creationism. It's almost the same, but not all of them are specifically promoting Christianity. But he calls it New Agey. That's an example of ad hominism. I also don't like most of what goes on in the name of New Age. Pop science, I guess they would call it, or pop everything. Pop religion, pop yoga, everything, just popularized and cheap. But we should consider also that many people are into intelligent design. They are qualified scientists who, especially that's well known in one of the most prominent people in intelligent design is Michael Behe, who, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it, but it looks like that. Who was a researcher in microbiology, I'm not sure exactly what. And he was, like most scientists, agnostic, if not atheistic. But his studies led him to conclude that the complexity of life at the micro level is such that it simply couldn't arise by chance. And actually, even before he wrote Forbidden Archaeology, Sadaputta Prabhu, whose PhD was in mathematics, I can't remember exactly which field of mathematics, but he wrote a monograph with the title Demonstration by Information Theory that Life Cannot Arise from Matter. Because he gave the, even if you say that life arises from matter under certain conditions, the probability of those conditions arising, according to what was known to science at the time, this must have been, I guess, in the 1980s, is such that it comes to zero. If you have, for instance, if you have something like 10 raised to the power of minus 1,000, for all intents and purposes, in applied in actual life, the chance of that happening is zero. You're more likely to win the lottery 10 times in a row. For instance, much more likely. Yeah, these people are into ID. Many of them are qualified scientists who went through the same educational system as everyone else. They have the same data available to them, but they see it differently. They interpret it differently. Which, I remember I was talking something about this in Belfast, one of the universities in Belfast, Northern Ireland, Queen's University. And at the end, someone stood up and said, well, what you're talking, that's bad science. which is another ad hominem term. But I said to her, well, you see, you can say that, but I'm a layman. I don't know science. I admit I don't know science. But when different scientists who all have access to the same data interpret it differently, how am I to know what's right? So science is supposed to be so objective, but there is subjectivity in it. If one scientist comes and says, yeah, we studied everything and this is what we find, and someone comes up and says something with the same data, with the same qualifications, and comes up with something different, it means that, science may be not so scientific or objective as we think it is. And of course, there is subjectivity in science, as was demonstrated many years ago in one of the most important books of the 20th century in terms of how it, well, particularly as it influences in the philosophy of science, is probably the most important book of the 20th century. And considering the influence of science, it's definitely one of the most important books of the 20th century. It wasn't written as a philosophical book, but its philosophical ramifications are more than its analytic ramifications. Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. One of the major things that he showed there is, believe it or not, scientists are also human beings. That wasn't a scientific discovery. But they have biases. They may be attached to certain theories. They may not want to believe something, even if the evidence, when they've been following a theory all their life, they may not want to relinquish it. Now, in his article, Aravindan gave an example of some supposed discovery which was later proved to be wrong because scientists investigated it more. So, of course, there are in science many cases where people, they're shown that their theory is wrong and they accept it according to the scientific method. But as Thomas Kuhn, one of his famous statements, I don't know it exactly, I'm paraphrasing, is that old scientific paradigms, when they're supplanted by new ones, it takes time for them to be supplanted. Because what happens is, all the old professors who believed in that, they go on teaching it, because they can't accept anything. And when the new generation comes in, then they teach the new thing. And as I've several times said also, I remember studying at school in the biology class, and we were told that a simple cell, biological cell, it's very simple, and very soon we'll be able to reproduce it in the laboratory. Well, that's what Michael Behe found out wasn't true, which made him into an intelligent designer. But then later on, I found out, well, we don't believe that anymore. We know by studying more that even the simplest cells are very complex. Then I found out even much later than even when I was being taught it, they already knew that. Because they didn't have time to update their biology books. So maybe even the teacher didn't know that what they were teaching is wrong from the scientific point of view. Of course, it gradually got sorted out. And another thing I often say is that if civilization goes on for, say, another 2,000 years, the way it's going on now, more or less, and there's more and more scientific investigation, experimentation, hypothesization, then we can expect that after 2,000 years, when people look back, they'll look at us, at the science of today, and think, oh, they're so primitive, they got so many things wrong. Anyway, they were doing pretty good for their time. So, in other words, what we consider to be good science now is almost certain to be supplanted by something else that they call good science. Anyway, I'm not going to get into science so much and all this kind of thing, because as I say, I don't know so much about it, and I'm sure Druta Karma Prabhu will reply to him in a much better way than I'm doing. But I'm just doing, I'm going to do so from an angle which Druta Karma Prabhu might not get into so much. He may get into the scientific stuff more. This article, the snapshot at the top, or the summary of the whole gist of the article, is given. There is innate danger in accepting religious texts as sources of the ultimate truth with respect to the domains of science through literal interpretations. And he's mostly talking in this article about Puranic descriptions of the creation of the world and how they're not to be taken literally. Now, Aravindan, his aim in life, or central to his aim in life, as we can understand from his activities, is that he wants to uphold Hinduism. But most Hinduism, as it's actually practiced, is based on belief in Rama and Krishna and Shiva and Durga. Literally millions of people every year visit holy places, Tirupati, Nathdwara, Badrinath, Kedarnath, Puri, and so on. They go to all these places I said, they're famous as holy places, Tirupati, Nathdwara, Badrinath, their holy place connected with Vishnu, Kedarnath with Shiva, the Ganga is worshipped, not just as a river, but as a goddess, and all these descriptions are in the Puranas. Here, the verse we read today, that Bhutagrama sa evayam bhutva bhutva praliyate, describes how the matter, the material world, various universes, they come into being and are again destroyed. So none of this is very scientific. If you want to believe in Rama, according to the description of Ramayana, and of course there's not, in various Puranas, such as Bhagavat Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ram is also described. And we understand from the description that Rama appeared between 19 and 20 million years ago. That's not scientific. That doesn't fit with scientific. I'm using the word scientific very loosely here. Of course, it is scientific, in as much we accept it as being true, but according to modern science, that is not possible. And what to speak of Ravana killing a 10-headed demon and so many other things that are described, jumping over the ocean, having a bridge of floating stones, talking monkeys. There's so much in Ram Leela people are prepared to give their life for at the time of the Babri Masjid destruction. So many sadhus, they died for that. They very strongly feel that. And it's all based on Puranic descriptions. Now, you could say, well, let's just take it allegorically. And you can try to make some imagination that, for instance, I'm just making it up on the spot here. Ram stands for good, and Ravana stands for evil. Ram stands for dharma, and Ravana stands again for evil, adharma. Well, it's true that Ram stands for dharma, but it's not that he's some imagination. Otherwise, all of bhakti just becomes just meaningless. And some people would say that also, those who... they wouldn't say it's meaningless, but they say it's not. It's a phase of maya which helps to bring you to the understanding. Bhakti, let's put it simply, bhakti is a stepping stone to gyan. And when you get gyan, then you understand shivoham. I am Shiva. And then... But this all belief in Rama and everything is not actually necessary. That's for less intelligent people. That's the idea. Although we see the writings, the philosophical writings of the Vaishnava Acharyas, certainly not the writings of unintelligent people. And it's not the approach. Yeah, he talks about metaphysics and Vedanta in this article. But the Acharyas who developed Vedanta metaphysics, and the most famous is Shankara, although he wasn't the first. His guru is also mentioned, Gaurapada. But he was the first very influential one in this Kali Yuga, if you accept that there's such a thing as Kali Yuga, and that time isn't circular. He was the first one to establish a metaphysical system based on the Vedanta, and afterwards prominent Vedantists were, especially Ramanuja and Madhvacharya, these three are considered, always considered the big three in Vedanta studies. Now, implicit in that, oh, wait a minute. And just before I get to that, I'm going to go to one thing. I'm going to read from the penultimate paragraph of his Aravindan's article. He writes, this is not to say that epistemologies of systems like Sankhya, Vedanta, Jain and Buddhist worldviews cannot provide valuable insights as well as frameworks to study problems such as what is life and what its origin is. As what is life and what its origin is. I'll read that again. This is not to say that epistemologies of systems like Sankhya, Vedanta, Jain, and Buddhist worldviews cannot provide valuable insights as well as frameworks to study problems such as what is life and what its origin is. Now, in other words, he's taking them as paradigms, something to be looked at. You can gain something valuable from it. But that's not the way they present themselves. They all those who have presented, and again, it's Sankhya, Vedanta, Jain, and Buddhist worldviews. And of course, there's not one Buddhist worldview. How many are there? Well, there's at least Theravada, Mahayana. Within Mahayana, there's the Madhyamic and the... I can't remember the names. And there's Yogacara and Vajrayana. There are so many different schools of Buddhism. And Vedanta also, there are at least three prominent schools, as I just mentioned, the three Acharyas. But anyway, in a general way, we can speak of Vedanta, Sankhya, Vedanta, Jain, and Buddhist worldviews. But all of those who have given these worldviews, they all claim them to be the way, absolutely correct. So you can't claim to accept them or without rejecting their central thesis. If you just take we can mix together the Buddhist worldview and the Vedanta worldview. But those who have given these worldviews specifically differentiate themselves from other ones. And much of what Shankara gave, Shankara and his Vedanta exposition, was against Buddhism. Although it's prachanna bodha mucchate, it's actually... His idea of Brahman is very similar to the Nirvana of Buddhism. as some commentators have pointed out, not Ramanuja and Madhva. They oppose Shankara's Vedantic worldview. But generally when people say Vedanta, I can just imagine, you may correct me if I'm wrong, that generally when people with this kind of outlook, they want to mix everything together, they generally, when they speak of Vedanta, they think they mean Shankara. Shankara's Advaita Vedanta. But Vedanta epistemology is not only Shankara. The Ramanuja and Madhva were commentators on Vedanta. And both of them, although they both wrote important commentaries on the Vedanta Sutras, Sharirika Bhasha is that of Shankara, Sri Bhasha was that of Ramanuja, Purna Pragya Bhasha is that of Madhva. But Ramanuja and Madhva, among their important works, were their commentaries on, in the case of Ramanuja, Vishnu Purana, he gave great importance to that. And Madhva gave great importance to Mahabharata and to Bhagavat Purana. He wrote his Tatparya Nirnayas on both of these works. So these are at the center of their epistemology in the case of these Vedanta Acharyas. And Shankara, of course, he praised the Bhagavad, he gave much importance to Bhagavad Gita. He also wrote his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning of which, in the very beginning of which, he stated Narayana Parovyaktat, that beyond the unmanifest is Narayana. So he accepts the existence of Narayana, and he, which means the worldview that from Narayana have come all the universes. Narayana means in whom all living beings rest. When they, as is said in this Gita verse, Bhutva, Bhutva, Praliyate, they go back into him. He, in his praise of Bhagavad Gita, he gave importance to Mahabharata, which describes gods like Dharma, Vayu, Indra, the Ashwini Kumars, who, I'm just saying their names, there's so much in Mahabharata, because these are the fathers of Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, and Nakula and Sahadeva, respectively. So, in other words, all these acharyas, who all accorded prime importance to Shruti, which means Veda, which includes Vedanta. Vedanta means the Upanishads. And the Vedanta Sutras, which were actually given by Vyasadeva. They're not directly part of Shruti. They're in the Triprasthan. There's Shruti, Smriti, and Nyai. Nyai means Vedanta Sutras. Shankara also, as all the Vedanta Acharyas, accepted the Puranas and Itihasas. Itihasas means particularly Mahabharata and Ramayana, although others, Valmiki Ramayana, although some people might want to include in that works like Ananda Ramayana and Adbhut Ramayana and Yoga Vashishta and works like that. But anyway, they all the Acharyas give importance to Purana and Itihas as part of an integrated whole. The Vedas means the Shruti, the Smriti, Mahabharat, Itihas, Purana, it's all part of one integrated worldview. It's not that. What you see what Aravindan's suggesting here, not directly, is that if we can accept the Vedanta, Sankhya, Jain and Buddhist worldviews, but the Puranic worldview, we can't accept that because you don't take it literally, he says. But all the acharyas who are the great expositors of or explainers of the Vedanta, they all accept this worldview from the Puranas, which is described in the Puranas. And you can't take part of one and reject the other, because if you say, well, in the Puranas there's all these things described about, you know, different planets with different living beings on, how can we accept all these things. But if you're going to accept, if you're going to be an apologist for Hinduism, one of the most basic tenets of Hinduism is belief in karma and reincarnation, as is discussed in Bhagavad Gita, that urdvanga chanti sattvasta, people go up. Where do they go? They go up to swarga, tetang bhukva swarga lokam vishalam kshine punye martya lokam vishanti. By pious activities, people go up to swarga, and then they fall down again. And it's also narak, hell, is mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, both by Arjuna at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. He mentions that people dwell in hell by not following dharma prad. Trivitang narakasyedam dwaram nasham atmanah kama krodas tata lobas tasmat etat trayang tyajet. Krishna says the three gates to hell are lust, anger, and greed. Therefore, they should be given up. So what Krishna is referring to in Bhagavad Gita when he speaks of heaven and hell, you can say it's allegorical, but as Arjuna understood it, and as all the acharyas have understood it, are the descriptions of heaven and hell as given in Shastra, particularly in the Puranas. And how you go there, and how you can go there, you go by pious activities, maybe Vishwamitra will try to send you up like Trishanku, but it didn't work, he got stuck. But even in the Shruti, if we say, okay, we're talking about Vedanta. Vedanta means Upanishads. But even in the Shruti, Upanishads, then we have in the Kathopanishad, if we, of course, there are supposed to be 108 Upanishads, but 11 principal Upanishads, sometimes said to be 12. So among them, Kathopanishad. The central story of that, of course, the philosophy is this discussion of the nature of the Atma, but the story on which it happens, which all the acharyas accept to be real, is that Nachiket, he went to the place of Yama. Not to hell exactly, but just in the waiting room. He was waiting for 3 days for Yama to come. Yama was off somewhere else, on holiday, something like that. So, that there is a Yama Loka is accepted in the Shruti. Then we have in the Keno Upanishad, there's a discussion between Shiva and Uma, describing how the different demigods became very, what we call demigods, devas, let's use that word, such as Indra and Vayu became very proud and they thought they were very great, and then a yaksha came. So anyway, philosophical points are made there, but that there are demigods with their respective planets and respective powers. Vayu blows the wind, he's the demigod. It's not just that there's different pressure in different places. You can say from the scientific point of view how the wind blows, but behind it is Vayu, Devata. This is not only the Puranic worldview. You may want to kick out as allegorical or stories for people who don't know them. But if you want to talk about Vedanta, you have to come to the Upanishads. He's talking about here he speaks about Vedanta metaphysics. What is it? At the beginning of the article. Yeah, about Vedanta metaphysics. So Vedanta metaphysics means Brahma, Atato Brahma Jignyasa, Janmadhyasya Yataha. These are the first two sutras of the Vedanta sutras. Now we should inquire into the nature of Brahma. Brahma is the in Vedanta, Brahma is the substratum of everything. That is the metaphysical reality to which we try, which we have to understand or realize, is a better term, in Vedanta metaphysics. So, Janmadhyasa Yataha, and Atato Brahma Jigyasa, then Janmadhyasya Yataha. Brahma is that from which everything emanates. So these first two aphorisms, all of the Vedanta Sutras, they're all based on various statements in the Upanishads. So these two aphorisms are based on the statement in Taittiriya Upanishad, Yato va imani bhutani jayante, yena jatani jivanti, yat prayantyabhi sangvishanti, tad vijigyasasva, tad brahmeti, that Brahma is that from which everything comes, that from which everything rests, and that in which everything, not really rests, yena jatani jivanti, in which everything, everything moves, jagat, the word jagat, gacchititi jagat, that which keeps on moving is called jagat. So everything moves, and then it goes back. Everything re-enters into Brahman. So that, yeah, well, it doesn't say, yatova imani, yena jatani jivanti, yat. So all these prepositions are used, or exactly the grammatical term, I don't remember. Pronouns, these pronouns are used. And what is that? Yat, tad Brahma, that is Brahma. So this is the subject, Brahma is the subject of Vedanta metaphysics or mysticism, as you may say. But that this Brahma is the source of everything material is accepted in the Upanishads. So this is the Vedanta worldview. The Bhutva Bhutva Palete, same thing. Bhutagramam saevayam Bhutva Bhutva Palete Radragameva Shaparta. What's the last line? You got it right there, you can see it. Prabhavatya Haragame, yeah. So this is also just stating that same statement of Taittiriya Upanishad. It's the same thing said in another way, but it doesn't specifically mention the agency of Brahma or the. So Brahma then is not, according to the Taittiriya Upanishad, Vedanta, Brahma is not only some metaphysical reality beyond everything, but it is the substratum of everything here in the material world also. Exactly how you interpret that and understand that may be different. In the Shankara Sampradaya, they say Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. But even if you say it's Mithya, it's very clearly from the statement of the Upanishad that is manifested from Brahma, this is the Vedic worldview from the Upanishads. Now that is given in the Puranas, in most of the Puranas. That's one of the lakshanas, one of the characteristics of a Purana, that they will describe the creation. So they all describe the creation. They all give it in detail. And you may say, well, that's not very scientific. We'll just go to the Vedanta for metaphysics. But the Vedanta states in brief what is given in the Puranas in detail, how the material cosmos has manifested. And that's also linked with the Sankhya philosophy. It's the description of the creation is about the different elements, how they come into being. Anyway, I'll get back to that later. So if you want to say that, well, we accept Vedanta, but we don't accept the Puranic worldview, then it's Ardha Kokoti Nyai, half a chicken approach. That if you say, I like the backside of a chicken because it gives me an egg every day, I don't like the front side because I have to pay to feed it, so cut it in half and then I'll just keep the back half. But you end up with nothing. So if you say we accept Vedanta, of course he doesn't say he accepts it literally. He says we can accept it as a worldview to provide valuable insights, as well as the. So he's, in other words, he just takes it as some kind. According to this, from what I can understand, he doesn't accept Vedanta in the way that the acharyas who have founded the Hinduism, who he wants to defend, he doesn't accept it in the way that they have presented it. That Shabda is the Vedic sounds. They are to be accepted as the authority. And he's trying to counteract Western influence. But it seems that he himself has become a victim of it in accepting science, which is based only on pratyaksha and anuman, on observation and hypothesis. And then again you experiment, and then, observation, hypothesis, experimentation, and then you come to a conclusion. And then someone does some more pratyaksha and some more anuman, and they come up with a different conclusion, and then you go on in science like that. And it's called progress. But the Vedic worldview, we can say broadly, and that is that, with Vedic worldview means you accept Shastra as authoritative. And that's both the Mimamsa and the Vedanta schools. They accept the Shabda, that is the ultimate Praman. And they've pointed out the difficulties in accepting Pratyaksha and Anuman as the main Pramans. And actually, if you consider that we're tiny, tiny, tiny living beings in a universe which is so vast we can't even begin to imagine how vast it is, we're only here for a very short time. We have no idea. If we take from our own, if we just take cogito ergo sum, I'm here and I'm thinking, as our basis of our epistemology, I know I exist. And we start from there, pratyaksha, examining everything. How much can we expect to know? Even building up generation after generation. We're such tiny living beings, so the Vedic worldview is to accept revelation. Now this is a very, very big subject, and it's never going to end, because there is no end to it. unless you accept Vedanta. You accept Veda means knowledge, and Anta means the end of knowledge. So within Veda there's, again in the Upanishads it's stated, there is paravidya and aparavidya. The Vedas, they speak of materialistic knowledge, aparavidya, and they speak of paravidya, spiritual knowledge. And actually they come together in the Puranic understanding, because we understand that everything in the material world emanates from Brahma, and specifically Vishnu. The Puranic worldview is highly theistic, in the sense of a personal God, upheld by the Vaishnava Acharyas. The worldview of modern science is agnostic at best, if not solidly atheistic, because of its methodology, pratyaksha and anuman. Because you can't see, touch, taste, smell, feel, or even imagine by mundane intelligence that which is spiritual. Achintya kalu ye bhavana tans tarkena yogi yat prakritebhyo yat. The Mahabharata states that you can't understand that which is inconceivable, so don't even try to. By our own intelligence, we can't understand. Our intelligence aided by spiritual knowledge. And you may say, well, that's not very scientific. Well, yeah, it's not scientific if you take science to be that which is... If you have the confidence that science, just by pratyaksha and anuman, can tell us everything that we need to know. But even some Western philosophers, and I'm particularly thinking here, and there are several others, Karl Jaspers, not so well known, but if you study philosophy, you'll know his name for sure. He's one of the prominent philosophers of the 20th century. He pointed out the limitations of science. And beyond science, there is that which is metaphysical, that which cannot be measured. And interestingly, one of the meanings of Maya, which is a central phenomenon or a theory or paradigm in Vedanta epistemology and metaphysics, is Maya, which means that we can't understand by science or by any material means. There is a method to understand. As Shankara points out, you can't understand everything by yourself. You only have one short lifetime. Therefore, tad vijnanartham sagarom eva abhigacchet. You have to go to a guru who, acharyavan purusho veda, who's got an acharya, he can understand the Vedas. Because there's so much that different people have come up with and so many different ideas in the course of time. You don't have enough time in one lifetime. So the acharya means one who's learned from his guru, and then he teaches you. And then you learn what you need to know, because we can't know everything or refute everything. Oh, what I was going to say about Maya. Maya means the attempt to measure everything. So that in itself, in the Vedanta worldview, it's in a clash. So you're trying to uphold Hinduism and at the same time uphold modern science. And at some level that might work, but when you come to examine in more depth, the two worldviews are actually at odds with each other. This is what I wanted to say in particular about that. Now, we're talking about Vedanta, then Shankara. Yeah, Shankara himself, he composed prayers to Narasimha and to Lalita, to Durga, Saundarya Lahiri, his waves of beauty, he's described her. We accept, all followers of Shankara and all followers of the Vedas, the Vedic culture, we can say at the present time, they all accept the description of Shankara's lifetime, that in his lifetime he was debating with Mandana Mishra at Mahishmati. Mandana Mishra was a great Mimamsaka. Shankara mostly converted followers of the Vedas, the Mimamsa Vadis. So he was debating with him, and he defeated him in debate. And then Mandana Mishra's wife, Bharati, she said, okay, you defeated him, then you have to debate with me also. Then you can say you've defeated him. I said, okay, all right. Sannyasi don't usually talk with women, but can't refuse a debate. So, okay, we're going to talk about any topic of the Vedic knowledge you can debate. Okay, I'm going to talk about sex. And Shankara said, well, I don't have any experience of that. So that's also part of the broader Vedic corpus in Karma Shastra. I said, okay, well, I'll give you a little time. You can find about it and come back and then you can debate with me. I'm a sannyasi. How am I going to find out about this? Okay. So he found out what to do. He parked his body in the jungle, in a cave. And by his yoga siddhi, he left that body and entered the body of a king who was about to die, and rejuvenated that body and lived in that body. And the king had many wives, as kings used to do, and he found out all about sex. In the meantime, his opponents found out that he's left his body in yogic suspension, and they wanted to, if we kill his body, then he's somewhere else. He'll have to start all over. We won't kill him because he's in another body, but the reputation that goes with that body, he'll have to start all over again. So anyway, they had some plan to kill him. So they went to kill him, and a lion came and killed them all. And Shankara, he recognized this is Narasimha, So he composed prayers to Narasimha. Now Narasimha, which evolutionary form is he? Half man, half lion, coming out of a pillar. Shankara, the great explainer of, I'm just forgetting the word, expositionist, whatever, all these fancy English words, I can't always remember them. Expounder, not such a fancy word. The great expounder of Vedanta accepts Narasimha to be reality, and it's intrinsic in his life story that Narasimha protected him. And then one of his, who is that, Padmapad, prior to meeting Shankara, there's another story of some hunter boy in the jungle who had darshan of Narasimha, but he couldn't have it because he was so proud at that time. And there are all kinds of things, how his name is Padmapad because Shankara was on one side of the river and he was on the other side of the river, and Shankara called him, come immediately. So how could he come? He walked over the river, and wherever he put his feet, then Padma, lotus leaves, came, and they were strong enough to support him. So he got the name from that. So, you're going to believe all this? Well, if you're going to accept Shankara, you should believe all of this also. It's all part of his lore, L-O-R-E. What would Shankara say now if he was here now? Would he accept modern science and, oh, there's no Narasimha? What would he say? Well, the Shankaracharya of Puri, who's supposed to be his representative, he made a big fuss a few years ago, along with many other Hindus. He made a big fuss about the plan to break the Ram Setu, which you can see from NASA photographs. You can see under the ocean there's a trail under the ocean between Rameshwaram, not exactly Rameshwaram, what's the name of the place? Dhanushkoti, to Lanka. So that can be seen, and it's some upraised all the way. There's some upraised earth or something like that, looks like that. And the government of India, and probably Sri Lanka also, they wanted to break that to make a shipping passage, which would save maybe 300 kilometers in shipping, and that would be very convenient for shipping. But Shankaracharya said, no, you can't do that. Stop it. No, you can't. This is Lord Ram made this. You don't do that. So it was a few years ago during the time of the Congress government, last Congress government. I won't say anything about Congress just now. So what would Shankaracharya say now? Well, his representative is there, and he says this is made by Ram. How many? Some millions of years ago. Himalaya, Stavaranam Himalaya, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, I am represented by Himalayas. According to modern science, they are a young formation of mountains. There are much older ones. They've recently come into existence. Yeah, science doesn't jive with... It just doesn't jive with the Hindu worldview. If you say Hindu worldview is based on Shastra, you can't avoid the Puranas. You can't say, well, when Krishna talks, Najayate Mriyate Vakada Chindayang Bhutva Bhavita Vana Bhuyaha Jo Nityang Shashvato Yang Purana Nahanyate Hanyamane Sharire, that the soul for the soul, it was never born, it never dies, no one can kill it, it never came into being. It's eternal, unborn. You can say, okay, we accept that. That's from the Upanishads. That's almost the same as a Kathopanishad verse. But then we don't accept that. I don't know. It's pretty much everything you can't accept because we can't accept Himalayas and Lord Shiva All these, you can't, it's half a chicken philosophy. What Hinduism are you defending? Some concept of Hinduism in which everything is not really real. All the millions of people who go to temples every year, to the temples of Shiva and Rama and Krishna and Durga and Ganesh, it's not really true. They're just stupid. In other words, you're saying that most of the Hindus are stupid. Well, in one sense, yeah, everyone in this material world is stupid, but then why defend this Hinduism then? Why not just go and be a Shankarite and pursue liberation from this world? Of course, you can't do that unless you're born Brahmin, according to Shankara. You can't even begin to pursue liberation unless you're born Brahmin, and then you take sannyas. So, of course, you can be a good Hindu and visit the temples, and then maybe in your next life you can be born as a Brahmana and then take sannyas, and then you can get liberated. But in the meantime, how are you going to... The metaphysics of the Upanishads based on karma and reincarnation, and the Vedas, all the Vedas for performing yajnas to go to heaven, a large part of the Vedas, so it's understood. There are heavenly planets. Where are they in our telescope? You didn't see them. So what does that mean? Either science is wrong, or the Vedas are wrong, or is there some go-between? My point is that you just can't flippantly reject what he calls dogmatism. Dogmatism to accept the Puranic worldview. But then you're insulting, at least indirectly insulting, all our acharyas, that they're dogmatic in accepting all of this. And dogmatic means they just accept it without any reason or understanding, and we know better because of science. So you really have to decide. When it comes down to it, if you get into it more deeply, you're going to have to accept modern science, which rejects, a priori rejects, without even getting into it, things like ten-headed monsters, like Ravana, and the whole material cosmos is destroyed by Lord Shiva's dancing. You're going to have to reject all that. Or, if you accept Hinduism, again I'm talking in broad terms here, as it's traditionally been understood and still widely conceived, then modern science doesn't fit into it. It is a clear dichotomy. You can say, no, there are so many things in Hinduism which fit science, maybe, but at the basis of their worldviews, there is a clear dichotomy. It's rather superficial to just try to reject the Puranic statements without investigating the massive underpinnings they have to what is conceived of as Hinduism. I'll just make... No, I think I'll finish here because it's getting late. Anyway, I just want to say that, okay, Aravindan, very good scholar, no doubt. But a scholar of his caliber should, and investigative, he's not afraid to confront controversial issues, but I would request him to examine the issues thoroughly before writing such a dismissive article. Try to understand it more. Why is it then that all the acharyas... Go and see the Shankaracharya in Puri. I went to see him once. He's open. He'll speak to you. He spoke to me. I even have it on video, actually. He allowed that Haridas was there. He was shooting it on video. So go and speak to him and see what he said. Why do you believe in Ram living 19 to 20 million years ago and made this bridge of stones? It's not scientific. Huh? See what he says. It's good that... Let's see now if this issue can come up more. Let's discuss it more so that thoughtful Hindus can examine their roots in Shastra. Blithely you can believe in, just like Sadaputta, one of the authors of Forbidden Archaeology, I was speaking with him once, and he said that what he sees, Hindus, they are able to, and that is in one of Rajiv Malhotra's books, he mentions this, and it's a well-known thing, that the ability to at the same time hold differing worldviews is not possible in Western understanding, but in Hinduism it is. So Sadaputta said that Hindus at work, they believe in the modern science, and when they go to the temple, they believe in Hinduism. And you can see, sometimes I'm surprised. I'm sitting in front of a large group of people who are well-educated in science or technology, engineering. We have so many engineers. And you'll talk to them about Ram killing Ravana, and they don't blink an eye. Yeah, they accept it thoroughly. And then they go to work, and it's all based on, you know, engineering, which is based on geometry and mathematics and physics and so many things like that. So, all right, well, why don't we think about it some more? Is this real, what is stated in the Puranas? If not, you're going to have to throw out all of Hinduism and just be a straightforward atheist. Join Christopher Hitchens or somewhere. Where is he now? Well, according to the Bhagavad Gita, he's probably in hell, almost certainly. Yeah, it'd be good if the Hindus came to examine their roots in Shastra. It might have, among other things, it might have the good effect of throwing out Sai Baba. We should have our roots in Shastra. Maybe more dangerous than all the things which Aravindan has exposed in Breaking India is that modern Hindus, more dangerous to Hinduism, is that they don't know their Shastra. They don't think it's important to follow Shastra. And then, ya Shastra vidim utsrija vartate kama karataha nasa siddham avapnoti nasukang naparam gatim. Then, if you don't follow Shastra, then you go to hell. And then you don't believe in hell. So please think about it more. And I'm sure that Druta Karma is going to have something to say also. I sent him the link, if he hadn't already seen that, which he probably has. He's probably come back with a rejoinder already. So, Hare Krishna, any questions? A bit late, I know, sorry, but went on longer than usual. Anyone who wants anything? You're building your temple here based on Vastu Shastra. Very scientific. Not just scientific in the sense that when people think of Vastu, they think of the Vastu Purush, and someone may say all these kind of things. It's just some mythology. But the fact that they know architecture, how to place pillars in a certain way that they can support huge slabs. This is Vedic science. So it's not that Vedic knowledge is devoid of science. But it doesn't, the basic worldview doesn't jive well with science as is understood largely in the modern world. You can try and dismiss the Puranas, and that will might resolve some problem, but it's something like cutting out one eye because it hurts you. That's one way. If you have a pain in your eye, you go to the doctor, he says, well, I'll remove the problem and cut the whole eye out. So that's stated in Shastra, isn't it? That for Shruti and Smriti, they're the two eyes through which to see the world. Shastra Chakshuhu. So if you cut out if you say we only accept the Shruti, but then the Shruti also is completely, just like two eyes, they work together. So Shruti is completely in concord with Smriti, and you can't just reject part without rejecting the whole. Ardhaka Kotinya, half a chicken philosophy. Hare Krishna.